Totally Football Show. Today, Alisson. Liverpool get an expensive Brazilian, but still have a close shave anyway. There's people lining up to tear strips off him. Will it stay hairy back there, or has Alisson learnt a lesson? Also, Spurs Watford, Benteke what for, and West Ham what now? In the Totally Football Show. Sweet sounds of Reg Dwight on a very special weekend for Sir Elton. New stand at Vicarage Road, or new name on the stand at Vicarage Road, and a fat win for Watford, who continue their 100% start to the season. Here to discuss that and so much more today, we have Michael Cox.
Hello, James.
David Priest.
A very good morning to you, James.
And Daniel Story.
Good morning.
Daniel and Michael will be appearing at the Manchester Football Writers Festival this Monday evening. Yep. Tickets still available, Michael?
Well, I expect the event will probably have happened by the time most people hear this.
Really?
So we can get you tickets to some kind of commemoration.
All right, if you don't hear this in time, there is, of course, listeners, one other hope. And that is to come to Totally Football Live. Because Monday the 24th of September, Michael, you'll be joining me and Duncan Alexander and James Horncastle. That's at the southbackcentre.co.uk. That's where you get the tickets from. And then, Daniel, you're with us in Manchester again, Friday the 5th of October, us in this case being Horncastle and Rory Smith. Seetickets.com. Seetickets.com. Right, let's begin, with Sunday's excitement at Vicarage Road. Watford's 2-1 win over Spurs. Michael. Who, what, why, where, Watford?
Yeah, I mean, this was very unexpected, both the result itself, but I think the nature of the result,
right.
Because I think that Spurs were bullied, really.
Mm.
They were outfought, and that's not something we associate with Spurs. You know, it's usually Arsenal, who are said to be flimsy and not physical enough, maybe even Guardiola's City, maybe Sarri's Chelsea this season. But Spurs are a big side. They're a physical side. They're a pressing side. They're aggressive. But I thought they couldn't cope with the strength of Watford's front two, particularly when Isaac Success came on. I thought he was very good. And there was a couple of incidents where Tottenham's defenders were just shoved off the ball. And it's quite rare to see that as the kind of decisive factor at Premier League level.
Mm.
But I thought Spurs were just not good enough in that department. Of course, they conceded two from set pieces as well, two headed goals. So it was a very surprising display.
Right. Can you explain through the medium of Elton John's song titles exactly how Watford...
One thing I will say,
right.
I really enjoyed Martin. Do you hear Martin Tyler's line on Sky
yeah.
Sports? He can tell everyone this is his stand.
That's very nice,
which
isn't
is
it?
Brilliant, yeah.
Was there not enough sacrifice?
Good.
Troy Deeney, very much Captain Fantastic. I mean, there's a wide canon of Elton classics. Lots of people getting excited about their physicality. For example, AT, also writing in Thunder Butter, good name, who says, hats off to James Horncastle for tipping the Hornets for this win last Thursday. And Gavin Cleaver, who's curious to know why Watford are predicted to go down each season by pundits and bookies, but haven't spent a week in the relegation zone since they were promoted. Now, are there parallels with another team that was predicted for relegation but actually did really, really well right to the end of the season and won the title, Leicester?
Possibly. I think Leicester probably had a few more options than Watford have got at the moment.
Going forward?
Especially in the attacking sense. But I quite like them. The tweet that we had this morning about the physical part of the game.
Mm.
I think I've said before on his podcast, I'm all for that side of the game. But it's more than that as well. They've got two players in sort of Etienne Capoue and Doucouré in midfield. I just think they're just two brilliant centre midfielders. And at the back, one massive upgrade they've made is Ben Foster. Now, he probably didn't have his best game.
Ben Foster and the Jets, as I call him.
Oof. I'm not a huge...
Are you not?
I'm not a huge fan. Well...
The early work?
I'm an admirer more than the fan, yeah. But anyway.
Okay. What about a Ben Foster?
Yeah, he's a huge upgrade on Cornettis last season. And even as well as Gomez did... coming to Watford, he was still sort of, he started to look his age, and Cornettis last season wasn't the answer at all. I'm surprised he got a move to Napoli, but Ben Foster, even though he didn't have his best game yesterday, he's made a big difference.
Mm. We talked about the defensive stats, but it was something that was picked up, I think, quite a lot on after this game, was a way that, similarly to that Leicester team, they let you play out on the flanks, but woe betide if you try and get anything into the box.
Yeah, similar structure. I mean, they play two up front in a different way to Leicester did. Okazaki was always dropping off, whereas I think here it's more that Gray can move out wide and work the channels. But yeah, there are parallels. And I think they've shown they can win in different ways this season. I mean, I think their best player so far has been Pereira, who was actually very quiet yesterday. And yeah, they won without him. Holivas has been very useful, obviously got the two assists. I mean, they do have options. They've got a good structure and... yeah, I didn't see this coming, to be honest, but it's been a pleasant surprise.
Winning the three previous fixtures, you could put down to kind of early season quirks or whatever, but to beat Spurs like this...
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Watford have done this before, maybe not quite to such extreme levels, where they start the season pretty quickly and effectively ensure survival by February.
Kiki Sanchez Flores.
Exactly, and then playing flip-flops for the last 3 months of the season. I would say, in Watford's defence, and I'm saying this purely in hindsight because I didn't see this coming, over the last 18 months, they have tried to do something different. Watford always felt like a slightly transient club where players of all ages, but particularly older players, were sort of just passing through, often from Udinese. The last 10 players they've bought have been 24 or under. So that indicates that they are kind of thinking of the future. And while not many of those players are in the first team yet, I think that probably sends a message to the players that are already there to say, actually, there's a bit of competition behind you now. There's some young, hungry players going to push you, which I'm sure must help. I agree. I love their central midfield. I know we will talk about West Ham later, but they are polar opposites in midfield. Two players who, with all the energy and all the running that you need, and two that have got none.
It's funny you were saying about what they're building behind the scenes, because Troy Deeney was doing an interview yesterday, and he was talking about how if you came to the club, you'd be very surprised to see that they're actually building from, you know, from the bottom upwards and from within, and he's thinking that, you know, there's an exciting future there at the club, rather than it being sort of, like I said, just a change after change after change.
Pretty exciting present as well. What about Spurs? We got a lot of pelters from Tottenham fans for not talking about them enough after last week's win at Old Trafford. So any thoughts on their performance?
It was a surprise that Pochettino didn't go with a proper defensive midfielder. I thought Dembele, really now, I think he's past his best. I'm not sure really they can rely on him. Was a great player a couple of years ago, but just physically doesn't look up to it. And I thought it was surprising as well that Pochettino took a long time to make any changes. It was after the Watford second goal where he first turned to his substitutes bench. But Watford had been kind of piling on the pressure. I didn't think the two goals felt against the run of play, and he didn't really seem to attempt to change anything, which was a surprise. I thought they started okay, Tottenham. They didn't create many chances.
What about Vorm's performance in for Lloris?
Yeah, I thought he was okay.
Knowing you, David, you're probably okay with goalies kicking the ball out for a corner. You know, it's probably like a defender's fault or something, is it? Did Vertonghen not show for him?
Well, do you know what? We'll go there later, shall we? We'll go there later.
Okay.
The one thing, having said about Spurs on Monday, that this was kind of proof of their cohesion and stability when they hadn't bought any players and kind of outfought Manchester United second half. When Pochettino did look to the bench and saw Fernando Llorente as his only attacking option, basically, I think they had a goalkeeper, two fullbacks, three central midfielders and Llorente on the bench. I know Heung-min Son is coming back and Lamela will come back from injury, but that just isn't enough.
Yeah.
At all.
Your son will be coming back. Or is it don't let the son do national service? I'm not sure. Don't go with that one.
We've got son, he's not a soldier. That's what I think Spurs fans are going to say.
Oh, okay. Yeah, nice one. Nice one. Super. Yeah, that's after South Korea beach ban in the early hours of Sunday.
You should have said he's from Seoul.
He's from Seoul, but
that's better, isn't
that's
it?
That's much better, Michael. Yeah. Spurs fans?
True? Do we care?
He used to play for Seoul FC. Whether he's from Seoul, I don't know, but I'm
that's
fine with that.
That's so much better, yeah. Okay. And it's so good, in fact. We'll just leave part one there.
You're listening to The Totally Football Show in association with Paddy Power.
Also on Maximum Points in the always exciting Premier League, Chelsea, who beat Bournemouth 2-0. Sarri's prediction said it would take his team 3 months to really come together. Is that an ominous warning for how good they're going to be in a couple of months?
I didn't think they played well in this game, but yeah, they've obviously got the results. And I thought the nature of the goals was interesting because they're both from 1-2s, and anyone who watched Sarri's Napoli will know they're all about 1-2s, almost just going up and down the field playing 1-2s. And as I always say, I love Olivier Giroud for his ability to just play those cute little passes as he did for the Pedro goal. Marcos Alonso really heavily involved again. All 4 games this season, he's been a real attacking threat. I think there's still more to come. I think Jorginho can be more incisive. Kovacic has been technically impressive without really starring so far, but I think he's a great player and will come good. It's going better than I thought. I thought they would have a period of adjustment, and they haven't really. They've just got off to a winning start.
OK, well, a 2-0 win for them, and Liverpool also maintaining their perfect record after 1 or 2 scares away at the King Power Stadium. Well done, Liverpool. But what everybody's talking about is what Tom Williams called Alison Blunderland. In which he... People say he attempted to do a Cruyff turn, but for me, it wasn't even that. He just kind of... He didn't really know what he was doing. But anyway, he gets pressured by Iheanacho, tries a deft little back heel, completely blows it, gets caught in possession. Iheanacho then centres it, and... Gazal puts it away.
Yeah,
and gives Liverpool a bit of a scare. Now, David, you were busy on social media.
I'm still busy.
Yeah, is it still kicking off?
Yeah. My own fault. I've brought it on myself.
Because you said 50% of keepers playing out at the back depend on the options the outfield players give them. Here, Joe Gomez, who everyone thinks has it otherwise, had an excellent game, did nothing to offer himself to Alisson. Given the philosophy and the style of play, he should go to receive the ball. He has time to do it.
Yeah. So, first of all, it's not a great back pass by Virgil van Dijk. He gets put in the mire a little bit by Hendo. He goes back to Alisson. Alisson's got to go out wide to retrieve the ball. Everybody says he should just hoof it up the pitch. Yeah. And I haven't said that he shouldn't have done that. Not my responsibility. What I try to do is give somebody a different perspective on what's happened. So for me to say Alisson should have just hoofed up the pitch, I think it's obvious. So everyone tweeting me that... Is just, you know, I'm not stupid. That's what he should have done.
Right.
But given the fact that it's Alisson, you've bought Alisson to keep the ball and keep possession. Mm. You know what he's capable of. You don't ask somebody to change their philosophy. And okay, in that one situation, he didn't do the right thing. But over the course of the season, Liverpool and City, from goalkeeper's possession, are capable of creating chances with 3 passes and under.
Yeah.
By doing that Cruyff turn and going down the opposition's weak side, the pace and the ability to counter-attack, they can be in the
so
goal.
You think it was that rather than, for example, as Canary Mark suggested, that he just got a bit bored and decided to try something?
Well, there is that as well.
Right, because the previous week, of course, against Brighton, there were a couple of near misses there, and you'd have thought maybe that was a bit of a wake-up call.
This is the first time, to my knowledge, in his career that he's been caught with a ball. And you can go across...
It's the third time in a week that he's come close, though, that he's been involved in a scary instance.
It's probably the 50th time in the past four seasons he's done it.
Right.
And so if you... did you use Y-Scout? Use Y-Scout. So there's one called Instat as well, where you can go look at all the games and everything. So you've gone that and you clip all his possessions outside the box and take-ons. That's the first time he's ever been caught like that. Now, he tried to do it because he's capable of doing it.
Right.
And, okay, so the ball goes out wide to him. Yeah, he couldn't recognise, but he wants to keep possession. His team knows he wants to keep possession. So their responsibility is to offer themselves. Now, a lot of people stupidly have said to me, when I've put this X, this is where Joe Gomez should be. They say, oh, well, look at him. That's where he's pointing for the ball to be played there. Alisson is going far to the right with his focus on the ball. Trying to keep the ball in play. He's got his head down. So he can't see Joe Gomez when pointing to where he wants the ball. Also, there's a striker coming across the passing lane as well. So he can't see that. It's impossible to see that. But what he could see in his peripheral vision, if he's got his head down, I can see a body straight ahead of me there. I can't see a hand, but I can see a body. So if he makes it more obvious and clear by changes position, which he has time to, then the pass is there, it's on, they play the goal at the other side. But even when he doesn't take the decision to do that, it's not on. He doesn't think, oh, I'm going to hoof it, I'm going to turn out. He's capable of doing that, goes out the other side, they're almost on the attack.
Right. Daniel, so, you buying this?
I absolutely agree that that's why he's been bought, and I also agree that he's capable of doing it. I think Jurgen Klopp after the game described it as a very good time for the mistake, because I think that's partly because Liverpool won the game, but it's also because of the incidents of the last couple of weeks. I think he probably thinks, not don't get clever with me or don't get arrogant, because he described Alisson as 0.0% arrogance. He said this is all confidence, it's not arrogance. I think it will offer him and his teammates a reminder that the Premier League is a high-intensity league, more high-intensity than Serie A was, certainly in the final third of strikers pressing. In Serie A, if he'd have got that back pass, the striker would not have been as quick to press him, I don't think, as Iheanacho was. So it is a different league, and he will have to learn. Klopp also said, that's the last time one of my goalkeepers will try a Cruyff turn in the box. So
it won't be.
I don't think he will be, but there will be a conversation between the two, I'm sure.
Don't constantly give the goalkeeper the ball. There are other solutions. Which is kind of like we spent 67 million on him, but best not pass back to him.
I don't know why he's saying that, because he's, like I said, he's capable of doing it. And so what you used to have when the back pass rule came in, all you got was defenders not even looking behind you, playing blind balls, and the balls would bounce around your neck. It was like, go on, you deal with it. Like, you know. Yeah. And really, defenders, even at the top level, there's still a hint of that, where they don't take everything into consideration. They don't consider, you know, it's not a considerate pass back to the goalkeeper. So it should be. Like I said, I'm not blaming Joe Gomez for that.
Yeah.
The responsibility lies with Alisson.
Mm-hmm.
Not once have I ever said that anything different. But it's just a coaching point from a goalkeeper and a goalkeeping coach perspective. That's exactly how I'd want to play. Even back when I was at Darlington with Jimmy Montgomery, we used to talk about playing out at the back.
Did you get scary moments like this?
Do you know what, for quite a few years, I got away a lot with, I used to allow the player come towards me and I used to kind of scoop it over their heads, until I played FC Midtjylland for Silkeborg and I kicked it straight at the striker and he took it around me. And it didn't stop me doing it, but it just made sure that I was...
Was it the defender's fault, though, for not showing?
Do you know what? It was, because I shouldn't need to do that. They should go up square.
Yeah, absolutely.
But like I said, it wasn't to blame Joe Gomez, which everyone has taken it as.
Right.
It was the fact that it's a coaching point. This should happen. And it's the same goes with Arsenal. Arsenal are awful at offering themselves.
Well, yeah, we'll talk about them later on. Michael, one last point on this.
Now Liverpool have got a throw-in coach. I'm just intrigued to see whether they bring in a Cruyff turn coach or a put-your-foot-through-it coach. That will dictate the philosophy for the rest.
Can we talk about that for a second?
Sure.
Because did you see the clip with Andy Greer and Richard Keys?
Yes.
And I had a little discussion with Paul Robinson on there.
Oh, my God, I dreamt about Richard Keys last night.
Oh, no.
I literally dreamt that I was somewhere and he walked in, and it was a really awkward moment. Anyway.
Well, do you know what? I'll say one thing. My experience of Andy Gray and Richard Keys have been all right, to be honest with you. I've been interviewed by him a few times, but it's... Mm-hmm. Anyway. They scoffed at this. Andy Gray scoffed at this. And even, like I said, I had a little discussion with Paul Robinson, ex-Leeds, Tottenham goalkeeper last night. And even he was like sort of like... emoji laughing face at throwing coaches. I've worked with Thomas Gronemark in Denmark.
Okay.
And I think Silkeborg was one of the first clubs he started with. He's comes from like an athletics background, I think. Not a throwing expert. He is now, but he was a throwing discipline.
Right. So he's the world record holder.
Yeah, he is. 55 metres or something like that. So so any discipline was like shot put, javelin, whatever. He was a technique coach to be able to produce a longer throw. And he worked with our fullbacks when I was at Silkeborg. And he put, like, I don't know, 10, 15 metres onto an average throw-in.
Yeah.
By the technique.
I think that it completely makes sense. I imagine he's not a full-time throwing coach. He's not there every day of the week.
No, he wouldn't be, but he'd be more like a...
Sure, he'll do the consultancy and then around. Yeah. But, I mean, when you look at what Iceland have done with it, and, of course, I mean, Stoke... back in the days of Rory Delap, it makes total sense. As much for the bad throw-ins that he'll eliminate, hopefully, to the amount he can improve the good throw-ins, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, it's not just that. It's all, every throw-in, no matter where it is on the pitch, is a set-piece situation.
Yeah.
So you can devise something in your own half, in your own final third, that comes up with something where you can get out the other side and attack and becomes an attacking situation.
It's the last great unexplored kind of area of improvement in that sense.
I did really like the fact that there's a wonderful irony to Andy Gray, roughly speaking, that kind of proper football man, football 4-4-2 style of pundit. Because the throw-in was the Stoke City proper football way of scoring goals. It was the kind of scene when it came in as really old school. Now it's become more scientific. Suddenly it's scoffed at, which seems bizarre to me.
Actually, when I was doing research for the book about the Premier League tactics, there's a chapter about Stoke, and I went back and I watched basically all the goals Stoke scored under Pulis. And one of the interesting things was that, of course, lots came from the long throws. But also a lot came because the opponents were so desperate not to concede the throws, they'd try and play their way out the back, lose possession, Stoke would win the ball high up the pitch. And what is Klopp's philosophy? It's all about winning the ball in dangerous positions. So it's not just the throws, it's what can, you know, lead from the throws and what comes instead of the throws. I think it's worthwhile.
Brilliant. All right. Well, in a second or two, we'll be having a look at what came out of the urn last Thursday in Monaco.
You're listening to The Totally Football Show, sponsors of Melchester Rovers. Find out more at RoyTheRoversOfficial.com.
Michael, have you seen The Matrix yet?
No.
Okay, you need to sort that out. David, you've seen The Matrix, haven't you?
I haven't seen The Matrix.
Oh, my goodness. Daniel?
I have, but I wouldn't be able to tell you the plot or anything really about
it. All right, let's hope we fare better with the Champions League draw, which happened on Thursday. Spurs, woo-hoo! They got Inter, PSV and Barcelona. Liverpool got PSG, Red Star, Napoli. You've probably seen the draws. Man City, Lyon, Hoffenheim, Shakhtar Donetsk. Man United got Young Boys, Juventus and Valencia. Spurs and Liverpool in particular, how worried should they be?
I think they'll both progress, to be honest. I think the other sides in their groups will be pretty nervous about drawing them. I think we can underestimate really how good the Premier League teams are. I know they didn't do particularly well in Europe last year, with the exception of Liverpool.
Yeah.
You know, I think the English clubs have underperformed for a few years, but on paper, I think they're probably four of the strongest eight teams, so I wouldn't have too many worries.
Interesting group the Spurs have got, though. PSV, who probably they weren't that worried about, but PSV, Michael, as you'd probably know, won 6-1 this weekend against Willem Twee. You've got Barcelona, who won 8-2 against Huesca. Huesca were newly promoted in the first top flight season. They'd only once gone to Nou Camp or Camp Nou before in the Copa del Rey. They'd lost 8-1. This time, though, they took the lead.
Yeah.
But still ended up losing 8-2. And then Inter, who finally got a win this weekend, 3-0 without Icardi, which was big. That was away at Bologna. Inter will only have a 20-man roster for the group stages on account of their kind of plea bargain with the UEFA. They're quite excited about the group, Inter. Gazzetta called it Inferno. But they said for Juve and Roma, it was a paradiso. They liked the Man United group. This was, of course, before Man United laid on that tour de force at Burnley. But, of course, there's a romantic thing of Cristiano Ronaldo back up against his former club. It's
very much the Jorge Mendes group as well. With he's had some impact for Valencia. He's obviously got Ronaldo, Juventus and Manchester United with Mourinho.
Brian.
And Young Boys versus Old Lady, which we can all get on board with.
That is good.
Makes note of that. Speaking of Juventus, of course, they maintained their perfect start with a victory away at the Tardini against Parma on Saturday. Quite a hard-fought game. Did Cristiano Ronaldo score? No, he did not. Mandzukic, you like the 1-2s, Michael. Mm. Did you see his delicious back heel?
Oh, he did,
the second goal, he sets up Blaise Matuidi. Gervinho scoring Parma's goal, so that was nice. Yeah. Cristiano Ronaldo, who's the headline on the Corriere dello Sport, was CR 5.5 for his kind of... They felt it was his worst performance so far. He's now had more shots without scoring than any other player in Europe's top five leagues this season. Not just more, but 10 more than the next player in that list. But, you know, it'll come.
The old Thomas Ince start, that, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, talking of back heels. Riallarga verso Berezinski. Cross dentro. Quagliarella col tacco! Da impazzire! Fabio Quagliarella! 3-0 Samp! Gol capolavoro del grande ex! Yep. Sampdoria there. The third of their three goals against Napoli, handing Carlo Ancelotti his first defeat of the season with the Neapolitans, who've, of course, they're in with Paris Saint-Germain and Liverpool and and whatever Red Star are really called. but yeah, what an amazing goal that was. What was this question from Matthew Barry? Would the pod celebrate like Quagliarella, i.e. not celebrate, or run around like a maniac if you'd scored a stunner? I mean, there's context here, isn't there? He is Neapolitan. He played at Napoli. And also...
He values his life.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah.
I like the non-celebration or the muted celebration in that because it almost acts as a perfect counterpoint right. to the spectacular goal.
Yeah.
So it was good.
And it was extraordinary, wasn't it?
Yeah, they came in kind of mid-90s as a new style of goal, that one, where it comes across you and it actually, although it looks fancy, sometimes it's an easier finish to play it with the side of your foot behind you than try and go sweep it across.
Roberto Bettega, there's an incredibly famous one in Italy, which was back in the 80s that he did.
Roy, 1995, okay. Nottingham Forest at White Hart Lane is the one that I jumped to, obviously.
And Zola, there's a classic Zola for Chelsea.
Yeah.
There's a
Norwich.
There's an extraordinary Mancini one as well, which we often talk about. Yeah. But this was so good because, A, he was about, 10, 12 metres out? Mm-hmm. Secondly, he was kind of... He wasn't inside the post, as it were. He was kind of beyond the near post. I don't know how you'd... Yeah.
And, I mean, I guess maybe one of the reasons he didn't celebrate like crazy was he scored so many spectacular goals that he's almost becoming accustomed to that. I mean, over the last 10 or 15 years, with the exception of Messi, I'm not sure there's many players who could put together a top 10 goals.
His showreel, yeah.
I mean, he's just... with the exception of last season, he hasn't really been a great goal scorer, but a scorer of great goals.
Well, he's had lots of issues, not least with his postman, and that's something that I think we might explore in Wednesday's Golazzo. You want a quag, you know, a wallow in the quag.
That finish, by the way, it's because it's so good because it's almost impossible to read as a goalkeeper.
Oh, right.
Because it looks as if you're leaving the ball for somebody coming in behind. So you almost relax a little bit thinking that you've got to move into the next one. It's already past
the speed of thought as well for Quagliarella because the ball's fizzed into him. Is it my best ever goal? No, it's in the top three, but I've scored from midfield a couple of times, so there are others to choose from. I'm just sad that I always end up scoring beautiful goals against my Napoli. Anyway, big win that for Sampdoria. And in what was, of course, an emotional game in many ways because it was their first game, you know, first home game since the bridge disaster in Genoa. We'll talk more about the Champions League, which will also feature Roma from Serie A, in Thursday's show when Alvaro Romeo and James Horncastle and Julien Laurent will be joining us. But should we mention, perhaps we should, the Europa League, which also had its draw. And what do you make of Arsenal's group with the Karabag, a Ukrainian side whose name is Vorskla, and Sporting Lisbon?
Well, the one, I mean, they will qualify top of that group, I have no doubt, but the one kind of takeaway from it is the sheer mileage they'll cover, which is three times as far as Chelsea will in their group.
Really?
Two properly long away trips, which obviously playing Thursday, Sunday football is potentially significant.
Right. Chelsea's group, by the way, PAOK Salonika, Bate Borisov, and Hungarian side Vidi. Two Scottish sides both through. Celtic are up against Salzburg, but they've got the two Red Bull sides, haven't they, which is intriguing. Salzburg and Leipzig and Rosenborg. Rangers have Rapid Vienna, Villarreal and Spartak Moscow. Speaking of Celtic and Rangers, of course, it was the Old Firm game this weekend. Anyone watch this?
Yep, I did, yeah. Rangers have... Because they have Steven Gerrard as their manager, there is a deliberate reason within English punditry and journalism to hype up Rangers this season, partly because we want a title race and partly because Steven Gerrard is a very famous former footballer. They were dreadful, absolutely
really?
Dreadful. They were embarrassing, actually, because they didn't try. Gerrard's explanation, or, you know, his grievance after the game was that a foul should have been given, which is true, but...
In the build-up to Celtic's
exactly.
goal.
But after 20 minutes, Rangers goalkeeper Alan McGregor, who was probably the man of the match, kicked a Celtic player and should have been sent off that wasn't spotted.
Right.
And Celtic had... I mean, I think I'm guessing here, but I think they probably had nearly 20 corners and Rangers maybe one. It was incessant pressure for 90 minutes. It was,
wow.
It was a 1-0 humbling. David was saying before, I won't steal his statistic, but David was saying before the show to me that's Rangers' worst start to a season since, I think, 1989.
29 years, yeah, they're seventh. There had been a lot of talk of how they'd improved under Steven Gerrard, but you didn't see that particularly in evidence against Celtic.
They may well have improved, but the gap is still monumental.
Chasmic, right. It wasn't just the Old Firm game this weekend, Michael. It was also the Old Farm game, which saw Norwich and Ipswich drawing 1-1. Also drawing this weekend, on Friday, was that big game between Borough and Leeds in the top of the Championship. You can find out all this totally good stuff in the Totally Football League show with Caroline Barker. That's on Tuesday. Just before that, Andrew Slaven will be giving his agreeably Hibernian take on events north of the border in the Totally Scottish Football show. I bet they'll talk about that ghost goal. Did you see this, Partick Thistle?
Oh, that was good.
Greenock Morton, what actually happened?
The Partick Thistle, I saw it through the Partick Thistle Twitter account, which I'm sure most of us did. And they just said, oh, this didn't cross the line then. And then just posted the video of a ball being thwacked into the back of the net. And the referee and assistant somehow coming to the conclusion that it was a throw-in. It was as bad a refereeing decision as I think I've ever seen.
Next up, back to the Premier League as we discover who Daniel Storey says are the accidental entertainers. Absolutely. Yeah, no, I think we've all got a fair idea that it's Arsenal that you're talking about, Daniel. You make them sound a little bit like a clown car. Was that your take on their performance away at Cardiff?
They are brilliant going forward and shambolic thereafter, which they were last season. And add to it this season that you have a new manager trying to implement his own philosophy, which a number of players in the team don't look as if they can get on board with. And they don't have the money to buy new ones yet. Yes, they do look like a bit of a clown car, although a clown car that won their first away game under Emery. The two stats I got yesterday were, firstly, in their last 19 Premier League games, a side has scored three or more in 14 of them.
Right.
Five against Arsenal, nine of them for Arsenal.
Huh.
And also, of the six games since the start of last season with the most shots, Arsenal involved in half of them.
Interesting.
They are a team that, it sounds very simple, but there's no other way of saying it. They are brilliant going forward and dreadful at everything else.
Well, this finished 3-2 to Arsenal. It could have been 3-3. It could have been a 3-2 Cardiff win, no? Were you more impressed with them or Arsenal, Michael?
More impressed with Cardiff, to be honest, because I still think their squad is deeply average with respect. I think it's a mid-table championship squad. And I was, you know, I thought coming into this game, if Cardiff were going to give Arsenal a game, it'd probably be in a tight game, you know, 1-0 with a set piece or something. But Cardiff attacked. They went for it. They pressed Arsenal in the first half. They caused Arsenal's defenders problems. I think Warnock afterwards said that they'd watch videos of Czech struggling to play out and they were going to press high up. And they did have a very good early chance through that. I think Warnock's doing a really good job. I know they haven't got a win yet, but they've kept a couple of clean sheets. They've given themselves belief. And I just think a performance like this, even though they didn't win, it creates a kind of feeling amongst the supporters that when a big club comes to town, let's be a bit kind of old school Stoke. Let's put on an atmosphere. Let's, you know, go and get them. And
right.
I thought they were really impressive, actually, Cardiff.
All right, and their first goals of the season through Camarasa and Danny Ward. Zelda Terrorhawk says, can you discuss how clearly terrified Petacek is of playing it out from the back? Do you think that's fair, David?
No, not really. I mean, he doesn't look the most sort of fluid footballer. Given that, he was actually a striker until his teens. Didn't turn goalkeeper until late, pretty late on. So you'd think he'd be more accustomed to that. Obviously, he hasn't been asked to do this job while he was at Chelsea. But I just think they just need to take the stabilisers off. It's almost like they're so sort of stiff and sort of, they're still restricted. They should just free themselves up and be braver with the passes. Because sometimes the one that he did give away...
To Harry Arter.
Yeah, so the two centre-half split wide, which it should. Granit Xhaka drops deep. And now Granit Xhaka, he's sort of like... He half offers himself. He's doing a bit the same as what Gomez is doing. He's sort of saying, well, give me it here. But he doesn't look convincing. And if he plays the ball into Xhaka and Xhaka plays out to Sokratis... They're out. It's perfect. It's so much easier than him trying to play that an eye of a needle ball through to the centre midfield. But I just think they're obviously working on it a lot. But like I said, they've got to be braver, and the defenders have got to give them act more like midfielders in the way they offer themselves and the angles they give the goalkeeper.
Right.
And all this it boils down to, you know, we talk about people talk about traditional goalkeepers and they should be taking chances and doing Cruyff turns things like that. This is what we're doing now. This is goalkeeping now. So, like, I've mentioned before on this podcast, Tim Dittmer, who's he's the head of development for goalkeeping at FA. Now, one of his ideas he comes up with is when the ball's maybe in the left-back position, that the goalkeeper takes up position on the other side of the goal. so that it's easy, he's in a better position to start an attack off down the other side, like we were talking about with Alisson.
Right, so the left-back would pass across the face of an
exactly.
open goal.
So that goes against everything that I was told as a kid, and being ultra-conservative, ultra-safe, don't do anything that will, that might risk giving a goal away. But at that level, you should be able to trust yourself to do that. Unless there's like an immediate threat, if you've got the freedom to do that, take a braver position on the other side. Be brave with it, like I said, with the passing as well. And there's some things I don't agree with safety. If you're going for a back pass, I prefer that, or rather that was done beyond the width of the goalposts. Mm. So if there's a bobble or a bad touch or something, then it's not going to concede a goal. Yeah. I agree with that. Mm. But the rest of it, be brave with it. It's not 20 years ago.
Interesting.
But that's a far bigger risk, that thing playing it across the goal. I mean, how often does a bobble result in the ball, in a back pass going in the goal? It's happened 3 times in the last 10,000 games, surely. It's just such a minor issue. That's the thing, surely, where you've just got to trust technique, you've got to trust the pitch. Mm. That, to me, that seems a bit of a contradiction.
What's a contradiction?
Because it's more risky to do that thing
to pass across
your open goal, which and I'm completely on board with the general point.
Not at all, because if you're unless there's somebody stood in that box.
Well, that's the thing.
Yeah, but
well, no, not even in the box. Anyone who can run onto that ball. The number of times you see a back pass made without the defender being aware of an attacker who's playing on the shoulder, who nips in, seizes on the back pass, and
messaging you.
But how can you say trust the technique and trust that kind of thing, which I'm on board with, but then say actually don't play a back pass in the goal if the keeper's
good. You should
there.
Take extra risk, yeah. Mm.
Well, no, it's not even a risk, it's just passing to just trusting that your goalkeeper can trap the ball.
Mm. But you're not actually playing that ball towards the goal. It's not a threat towards the goal. Mm. That pass across the goal isn't a threat towards the goal.
No, I know. I don't have a problem.
There's a direct consequence to a misplaced pass, not if you're playing it across the other side of the goal.
Anyway.
No, I'm just completely against this idea that you shouldn't pass back to the goalkeeper when he's between the posts, because I've seen a back pass go in because of a bobble about 3 times, and I've seen probably tens of thousands
of goals.
Is that right? It's just not an issue.
Were two of them for England? I'm trying to think what the other one was.
The Robinson one.
One of them was Nottingham Forest.
It happened to
against Derby County.
Happened to Brian Gunn once.
Mm, interesting. At the other end, Aubameyang and Lacazette combining well, Daniel.
Yeah, maybe I'm wrong here, and it sounds overly critical. To me, it felt like they were, for the goal, for Aubameyang's goal, they linked up beautifully. Actually, that felt like one of the only times in the game that they did really link up. And actually, in the celebration, they looked at each other and went, that was really good, let's do that again. They were both pretty good, I think, at doing what they did, but they seemed to do it in isolation. I thought what would happen if they played both of them is that Aubameyang would start out wide and Lacazette up front, and they would continually swap positions and make things really hard for centre-backs, drag them out. Actually, they kind of stayed pretty much as they were. Lacazette played as that central striker for almost the whole game, and until the goal, Aubameyang, I think, certainly the first half, was actually pretty quiet and didn't look to be enjoying himself that much on the wing. But it also should be said, they won't find defences constantly as accommodating as Cardiff's to do that. They've been excellent this season in keeping clean sheets, but they weren't very good yesterday, I don't think.
Right.
Arsenal fans will probably tell me different why Lacazette hasn't been in the side all the time or whatever, but when he plays, to me, he makes the difference. His intelligence and the way that he moves and the positions he takes up in offering himself, it's just it's totally different to what other
I think if they didn't have Mesut Ozil there, I think they would both probably start every game. I think the issue is whether you can have that high pressing with Aubameyang, Ozil and Lacazette all in the same team, because it asks a heck of a lot of Aaron Ramsey, who played really well yesterday, but it asks a lot of his energy levels.
Right, okay. Elsewhere on Sunday, Man United went to Turf Moor and had a 2-0 win, although there were one or two nervous moments after Pogba's penalty was saved, and then 2 minutes later, poor old Rashford got sent off by evil Phil Barnsley, basically kicking him over and then inviting his head in. But David, as a former professional, it's not instinctive. It surely isn't. I can't remember, and I've been in scraps, ever thinking I'm going to lean in hard with my head here.
But
why do players do it?
I've no idea.
Have you never done that?
Yeah, I have. But I mean,
it's... I mean, it would make more sense to kind of front up with your chest or something like that. But to lean your head in, you know what's going to happen.
It's kind of taking place of, you know, you're not allowed to raise your hands. If you raise your hands, then you're going to get sent off. So then they lean in, and then.
But that always gets you sent off as well.
Well, that's it. And it doesn't have to be sort of violent conduct. It's just the
like Richarlison's the other day was barely a nod.
Yeah, exactly. It's just stupid, and I think again, you can see he was provoked by Phil Bardsley, but he allowed himself
to be provoked. Phil Bardsley, who has now been headbutted by Marcus Rashford and reportedly punched by Wayne Rooney in that pre-boxing celebration. Mm-hmm. That was Phil Bardsley, wasn't it?
Was it?
Yeah,
right, okay, at his house?
Yes.
Right.
I've no sympathy for Rashford because you know what you're going to get, but I don't think those incidents need to be red cards, really. I think it's all a bit silly. I don't think it's really violent. Right. It's silly, but it's not violent for me.
Very disappointing performance from Burnley. Sean Dyche afterwards said, disappointment is quickly thought about in the same process as the reality. So there's that.
But Burnley are really, really bad at the moment. I know they've had Thursday night football, but they were kind of built on defensive resilience and they've conceded the most shots on target this season in the Premier League. And they've only played one team that finished in the top half last season.
Wow.
But those Thursday nights have ruined them. Really. Yeah. Not just because of the amount of games they've had to play or whatever. It's because they've had to change the way they play. They can't just go to those sides and just sort of shut up shop. They have to play a little bit more.
Right. Ben says he's going to get the relegation odds later on them. And I imagine West Ham as well. Newcastle... spirited performance away at Man City, especially compared to recent results for the Magpies there. In the end, it took a phenomenal strike from Kyle Walker to earn the champions the 3 points. Good performance from Martin Dubravka as well. Are you a fan of him, David?
Again, I'm a very big fan of his.
Right.
Very big fan.
Hey, what do you think about Alex McCarthy of Saints, who won 2-0 away at Palace?
Yeah. He's deserved his international call-up, I think.
Mm.
First time. I mean, he's 29 now. It's about time they had a decent run in the Premier League.
This game, Michael, Roy Hodgson afterwards saying we'll just have to get used to the fact that we can't win without Zaha.
Yeah, or can't win with Benteke because they had chances again. He had chances again. There was so much pressure towards the end. And then the second goal was in stoppage time. But I always think, you know, as a football fan... if you seal a game or win a game with a last-minute goal away from home, that's pretty much as good as it gets. I know that was the second one, but when you're under so much pressure and then there's a breakaway and a goal,
yeah,
it's great stuff. I really like the goal from Ings as well. You know, not a kind of goal of the month contender, but that kind of coolness outside of the foot. I must admit, I wasn't entirely sure about Ings. You know, they haven't technically signed him yet, have they? But there's an agreement in place to sign him for about 18 million, which sounded a hell of a lot of money to me. But he's played really well so far for Saints.
Sharp the weekend, didn't he?
Yeah, he's just a good technical player.
Very nice. Anywhere when Zaha is back and Palace can start winning games again?
2 weeks, I think.
So maybe after the international break?
Yeah, well, yeah, I think actually, although they clearly wouldn't have wanted to lose that game, I'm sure that one of the reasons for not picking him was because of the international break.
Right. Okay, Brighton and Fulham had a 2-2 draw. Glenn Murray powering the Seagulls back from 2-0 down against the Cottagers, who played some very nice football, I felt, in what I saw of this game. Simon Allison says, 4 games in, who do we think is looking like the best signing and equally who is looking like the worst? And then he puts Seri. I can only assume that's for the best signing because he's certainly not been the worst. Would he be among your contenders,
Mark? Yeah, I would have said Seri. Yeah. I also think Felipe Anderson's been excellent despite West Ham's complete lack of points. Against
certainly
Arsenal,
better than we expected, I think.
Yeah, against Arsenal he was sensational.
Who's been the worst then?
Well, there are a number of players who we haven't really even seen yet, which is quite bizarre. I know Fabinho is one who was signed for £50 million and has made one matchday squad on the opening day and that's it.
Burnt Leno
we haven't seen. Lucas Torreira, who...
yeah.
Anyone apart from Granit Xhaka's close family must be desperate to see on the pitch. That's been the strange thing for me this season, that the new indirect result of Premier League's awash with money is that you get these huge signings who don't even necessarily get in the squad in the first month of the season.
Mm. Everton's star signing Richarlison absent, of course, suspended for their game against Huddersfield, and very disappointing result this one, a 1-1 draw with the Terriers. We're actually not making a bad start to this season.
They're doing okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, in terms of, you know, setting up 10 men behind the ball and... hoping nothing happens.
Yeah, I think Everton are still coming together under Marco Silva. There's the right signs. I think they've done a couple of things very well. I like their set piece routines, for example. There's a lovely assist for Lucas Dean.
For Everton?
For Everton, not in this game, but in previous games.
Because in this game, the set pieces was what went wrong.
Yes. Yeah. Defensively, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Jay Evanson can, Michael, please explain how Silva can sort out Everton's zonal marking issue. 6 of 7 goals conceded from set pieces. Is there an easy solution?
It was a strange one, this, because I think an Everton player flicked the ball on at the near post, so it was a little bit... It was a difficult one for others to defend. I don't have any solutions, I'm afraid.
Marco Silva is, it should be said, not the coach you'd want to organise a defence.
Is he recidivist?
Well, it's 15 games now with Watford and Everton since he kept a clean sheet.
Oof. And worryingly, they only managed a single shot on goal in the whole of this game. So, very flat performance. And West Ham losing 1-0 at home to Wolves. West Ham now the only team still yet to claim a point. The goal here coming right, that you're talking about getting a goal right at the death, away from home, Adama Traore.
I liked this because I like the timing of the introduction of Traore, because it was 1 minute after Aaron Cressel had been booked. And I think the last player you want to come across once you're on yellow card is the fastest player in the Premier League.
Is he?
Yeah, he must. I haven't seen any stats, but he must be. I don't think I've ever seen such a quick player. He's incredible.
He's a sec behind Eden Hazard for completed dribbles in the Premier League this season. He's played 91 minutes, which is amazing.
Wow.
Yeah. Well, I mean, he's been doing it in the Championship for a couple of years. Just the dribbling stats, you know, you see these analytic graphs and he's just kind of somewhere in a different postcode. He's so far along the graph.
But am I right in thinking that he has all of that, but in terms of end product, he doesn't... He hadn't previously measured up particularly.
I haven't really seen enough for him, but I think that's... Nothing could match up to those dribbles or he wouldn't be playing for Wolves or Middlesbrough. Yeah. So there clearly is an issue there, but... If you're completing that many dribbles and there's some end product, then that's kind of enough, I think.
And of course, the goal came from an idiotic decision by Carlos Sanchez in midfield, getting dispossessed in midfield.
So Sanchez,
last minute of the game as well.
Yeah,
stupidly
who was
trying to,
supposedly going to be the guy who was going to steady the ship in midfield. Ben has those Adama Traore stats, by the way. They are last season in the Championship, 243 successful dribbles. To put that into context, that was 108 more than anybody else. Extraordinary. How much trouble are West Ham in? The next three games, Everton, Chelsea and Man United after the international break.
After last week's game against Arsenal, I was quite positive about them because going forward, they look great. They just look, again, like Arsenal. I mean, they should have beaten Arsenal, I think. Should have beaten for, you know, first hour of the game, they should have been 2 or 3 up. And both teams defended terribly, but that's a big worry for them. They didn't look as that stupid high line that they kept earlier the first couple of games, and they seem to have corrected that a little bit. But they are definitely they're persistent with it though. It's not as daft as it was the first game, but yeah, if 4 games out of win, it's a bit of a snowball in that.
They've kind of put their eggs in this basket because not only did they give Pellegrini a 3-year contract, they've also allowed him to choose his own director of football, who is Mario Husilos, who he worked with at Malaga, and given him a long deal as well. And then they've kind of spent a lot of money, and yet they've got... It's almost like a control experiment for how bad a team can be if you don't play with a central midfield. They finally dropped Mark Noble, bless him, on Saturday, but then they started with Carlos Sanchez and Jack Wilshere, and they're playing with attacking fullbacks and 3 attacking midfielders and basically telling Jack Wilshere that he's got to be the kind of firefighter, and it's not going to work because Carlos Sanchez is not good enough to do the job of one player, never mind 2. I think they're in big trouble if they don't solve it. I can't believe they haven't bought a better centre midfield.
How would they solve it? Is there anyone in the squad that they can... Or just by reining in the rest of the team?
The only other player... There's only the other 2 options they haven't really tried yet. One is Pedro Obiang, who came off the bench but was on the pitch when they conceded. And the other one's Declan Rice, who has played in central defence and central midfield. But, I mean, neither of them are the high-energy intensity players that you'd think would be needed to solve it. I'm kind of worried for them again.
All right, Michael.
I think they've signed good players and I think they've got a good manager, but I think there's a real undercurrent of, I don't even really know what the word is, just dissatisfaction at the club. It feels like a negative environment. The supporters aren't happy. They haven't been happy since they moved to that ground. It just seems to, a bit like Newcastle a few years ago when they were signing really good league on talent and they just weren't playing well, because I think you come into an environment where there's negativity and just not much will to win, perhaps. I don't know, but it's just... I thought West Ham were the most unpredictable team in the Premier League. I wouldn't have been surprised if they'd pushed on and gone for Europa. I wouldn't be surprised if they got relegated. And I think it will be quite a difficult one to turn around, to be honest.
Anyway. Now, I mentioned odds on Burnley. For that and more, producer Ben's been speaking to Paddy Power.
Thank you, Jimbo. Lee Price from Paddy Power on the line. As always, Lee, we're heading into the international break. And as we do so, there are 3 teams who have won all of their games, Liverpool, Chelsea and Watford. And I think no one expected probably all three of those to have performed so well at the start of the season. Let's talk about Watford, though. Are they the new Burnley? What odds can you give me for them finishing seventh or making the Europa League?
Yeah, I've been really sceptical about Watford, including on last week's show. So apologies to Hornets fans. They totally deserve to beat Tottenham. And they're now twice as likely to qualify for the Europa League at 7-1 than they are to get relegated, according to our odds. We make them slightly longer, 8-1 to finish 7th, but they're on fire at the minute. And I still can't quite understand it.
Well, let's talk about the old Burnley then, i.e. Burnley. They're having a terrible start to life and they're out of the Europa League. Are they going to get relegated this season?
We think they might, yeah. They're now third favourites to go down. Obviously, three teams go down, so that's perilous for them. They are 6-4, a very short price to go down. But that's not as short as Cardiff and Huddersfield, who are both odds on to get relegated already. Slightly harsh, I think, on Cardiff at least.
Well, let's talk about West Ham, Lee, who are very much rock bottom of the league. We talked about this a few weeks ago, rather facetiously, but it does seem to be bearing fruit, and I'd like some updated odds. Are they going to do a Palace? Can they go 7 without a win?
Yeah, Pellegrini can buy a £100 million squad, but he can't buy a win. This is a terrifying run of games, and they're actually odds on not to win one of their first 7 league matches, which is 4-9. And it's just 10-3 that they lose all 7, like Palace last season. It doesn't get easier either. They've got Brighton and then Tottenham next. No wonder Pellegrini's joint favourite to be sacked first.
And Lee, let's end on something a bit more optimistic. Let's talk about the top scorer. Salah and Kane are scoring, but it's Mane. Sadio Mane, who is top of the scoring charts at the moment, can he stay there?
This is really good value, this one. This is a good pick. It's 10-1 that Mane wins the Golden Boot, about double the price of his teammate Salah, although Salah is 11-2 behind Harry Kane and Sergio Aguero in the betting. Mitrovic, who is joint top scorer at the minute, is 33-1 if you want a long shot.
You can find out all these odds and more at paddypower.com. All prices are accurate at the time of recording. 18 plus only, begambleaware.org. And when the fun stops, stop. We're back on Thursday with, let's see who's in, James Horncastle. Oh, I mentioned this before, Alvaro Romeo and Julien Laurent. We're going to be discussing probably a bit of that Champions League stuff, but more to the point, the Nations League. The Nations League, which gets underway Friday. Is it Friday? I think it is. We'll find out that and other exciting details in Thursday's Totally Football Show. For now, many thanks to David and Michael and Daniel. Good luck in your trip to Manchester.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Where you'll be returning in October, as we mentioned before. Listener, have a great time with whatever you're getting up to. We'll see you Thursday.
You've been listening to The Totally Football Show, a Muddy Knees Media production. For sales and advertising, email sales@muddyneesmedia.com. And make sure you check out our other football podcasts, the revamped Totally Football League show with Caroline Barker and the brand new Totally Scottish Football Show. Supporting your team can be a beautiful thing, but then come the injuries, the goal droughts and the downright disastrous defeats. That's a little bit like life, really. And here at the Totally Football Show, we believe we should all support each other the way we support our team, through the good days and the bad. And that's why we're continuing to work with CALM, the Campaign Against Living Miserably, a charity dedicated to preventing male suicide. On average, 12 men take their own life every day in the UK. So that's your starting 11 and your manager every single day. And part of the problem is that many of us still feel uncomfortable talking about mental health and suicide, and this can often stop men from opening up and getting support when they need it the most. So if you're worried that someone close to you is having a tough time, check in with them and let them know that CALM is there. Every day from 5pm till midnight, CALM provide a free, confidential and anonymous helpline and web chat for any man who needs support. Visit thecalmzone.net to find out more about CALM.